From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter for BuzzFeed News, and Richard Lottendress, Washington correspondent for Canadian-based TVA Nouvelle. Our moderator is Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. America marks another September 11th. Russia and China team up for big military exercises. The on-again, off-again trade talks between the U.S. and China may be on again. And the latest European country to consider the impact of immigration is Sweden. We'll talk about that country's recent vote. Well, first, our listeners around the world might know September 11th as, well, just that, September 11th. But here in the United States, that date has a very different meaning, of course. It was 17 years ago when Islamic terrorists hijacked four planes, attacked New York and Washington, killing thousands. And Emily, from a policy standpoint, what happened that day? It was a long time ago, but it still continues to cast a long shadow over us in a variety of ways, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The reverberations of 9/11 are absolutely still felt today, not only in American domestic policy, but also in American foreign policy. It was a tragedy, and I want to say that first, but I do think it should also be noted that the United States' reaction in the wake of 9/11 is still remembered around the world in the Middle East by some of our closest allies. It is not necessarily remembered in a positive light, and that America went to war and took the actions that it did still clouds the way that many countries around the world perceive the United States. I would also note that the one time that Article 5, NATO's Article 5, has ever been invoked, that an attack on one is an attack on all, was after 9/11 by and for the United States. And allies around the world were there for the United States. You know that that's in doubt today because of the United States is also has also not gone unremarked on in the world.
You know, Richard, I gave a speech on this just a couple of weeks ago. In fact, it was my view as the anniversary was approaching that that 9/11 sort of led to, and this is why we're talking about it after all these years, is that it led to really, and Emily alluded to this, sort of a series of what I think a lot of people can fairly call a lot of strategic blunders on the part of the United States, Iraq, and so forth. What's your view?
Well, it feels like a series of missed opportunities from the Canadian perspective. I remember vividly the wave of solidarity, the burst of friendship on our side of the border that very day and the weeks and months that followed. Let's remember also that during that year, you know, there was a new government, a new president here. There was a legitimacy question in the air. And suddenly, you know, we were all with the Americans fighting this new threat against the Western ideals. Today, we look back and it's just troops on the ground still in Afghanistan, and we don't see a way out of there. And the Taliban, whatever we think of their ideology, they look like locals who want to get rid of foreigners on their ground. So where is this opportunity of being together and fighting for our values? And I have to say, Paul, that when you look at the attitude of the actual president towards partners and allies, Canada on trade issues, for instance, it leaves a lot of people a bad feeling, a bad taste in our mouth, because we thought that we had been so close and we did everything. We sacrificed soldiers on the ground for the U.S. fighting the extremists, and today this is the way we are looked at. You know, it's unfortunate. I feel there's a big missed opportunity there.
In fact, global surveys of countries around the world, I'm specifically referring to a Pew Global Research survey, has indicated that support for the United States, respect for the United States, has fallen rather sharply of late, too, has it not?
Yes, it has. But I guess to go back to sort of reiterate my earlier point, I think that Americans didn't fully appreciate how much credibility we lost after 9/11, and specifically with the war in Iraq. I was in Germany, 12 years after 9/11, and Germans there were still sort of saying, how could you do that? How could the United States do this? I don't necessarily put a lot of water in Russian arguments, but it's still every time the United States goes to intervene or points out Russian foreign adventurism, well, what about the war in Iraq comes up. It still clouds perceptions of the United States. And then when you add to that a president who questions traditional alliances, who's reportedly fighting with his own Secretary of Defense about, whether or not there should be more or less war, that doesn't necessarily help matters.
And some, in fact, say that the threat of terrorism today is overblown. President Trump is not one of those people who thinks that, though. But what is your view?
I think that I want to be very careful about how I say this. I think that compared to, guns in the United States, terrorism is statistically a smaller threat. That said, I can understand why in people's perceptions, terrorism is a larger threat, right? I'm not unsympathetic to what it did to the American psyche. And I think especially for, not to be millennial about this, but I was 11 on 9/11 and I'm 28 now. So the majority of my life, of my generation's lives, has been post 9/11, right? Has been this, our whole lives changed, our country changed, our approach to the world changed because of this terror attack. So I understand why it plays the place in American perceptions that it does. Having said that, we also have a president who uses rhetoric to get his own base out, rhetoric specifically about terror in the name of Islam, as opposed to terrorism by, white men shooting up Planned Parenthood clinics. Like, it's what I am saying is that I understand why the threat may be, quote unquote, overblown. I understand why it scars people as it does. I also think that we have some politicians who exacerbate that.
All right. Well, moving on here, and speaking of perceived security threats, the United States has also been keeping a close eye on Vostok 2018. That's the name that Russia has given to some really large-scale military exercises, the largest, I think, in about four decades. And China is also joining in. What's going on here, Richard?
It's very interesting because it's fundamentally a Russian military maneuvers, 300,000 troops. It's described by the Russian defense minister as the biggest one since the 1981 biggest of them all. So the 81 was like the heart of the Cold War, and now we're just going in the same direction. What's interesting is that Chinese involvement is not that big, 3,200 troops, but still it looks like there's a will of building a alliance there, a military alliance between the Russian and the Chinese. And even if Defense Secretary Mattis doesn't see in the medium run a serious interest between the two going further, still they show that they're getting together in front of a unipolar American, that's the way to describe this, American domination of the world. So I think we shouldn't underestimate, in Vladivostok, President Xi Jinping and President Putin were together flipping pancakes and eating caviar and drinking vodka. And they looked like they were getting along very well, not just at that moment, but looking at the maps and the work that's being done for this. And it felt, watching them and seeing the troops on the ground, that it was just isolating somehow from far the U.S. a little more.
Well, photo ops aside and flipping pancakes and everything, kind of positioning themselves as kind of an anti-American way, that's understandable. But there have been tensions historically between the Russians and the Chinese for quite some time. They nearly went to war in the 1960s, for example. How close can they really get?
Emily? Yeah, I was just going to caution that, I agree that it's certainly a statement against the United States, the West. I would also just caution that every few years they do this, where they sort of come out again with like the friendship of the Russo-Sino pact of friendship is alive and well, and then something always gets in the way, because you can't both be the great leader of the world and be best friends. Sort of like their interests run up against one another. Their territories are too close together. There's always something that breaks the Blini party apart.
I mean, they simply don't trust each other. The relationship can only go so far, is what you're
saying.
Yeah,
I would say that it's more a marriage of convenience than of love. They will act similarly on North Korea. They will vote similarly at the UN Security Council. these words could come back to haunt me. I don't know that they will ever be the closest of allies. And I think you're right that the cooperation can only go so far before cooperating becomes not in one party's interest. And they're never going to do that.
And there's some American analysts who say that the true threat from China, these land exercises notwithstanding, is really their big naval buildup in the Western Pacific. There are U.S. naval commanders who now say that U.S. Security guarantees in the Western Pacific can no longer be guaranteed. There are genuine concerns about rising China in the Western Pacific. Is that the more serious threat? That's what some people seem to think.
I would say that China is and has been very committed to maintaining that the South China Sea and the waters around China more generally are China's. But the South China Sea really hasn't been on, it's been on America's radar, but it hasn't been sort of the A1 story. But it still is for China, right? And this is the thing, and the point that I think that American analysts and military commanders were making, is that even if qualitatively the U.S. military is still superior, China is really committed to this. And that's not only in terms of where it's putting its military capabilities, it's also in terms of what it is willing to spend on the South China Sea and the Pacific more generally. The U.S. announced $113 million investment on business spending in the Indo-Pacific. That's compared to a trillion, that China is spending on One Belt, One Road. And the last point that I would make here is that actually this week we saw further evidence of sort of the marriage of China's military maritime power with its financial commitment to the project, because China and the Philippines finally settled this who has access to the Reed Bank, right? There was the 2016 International Tribunal ruling that said that those were the Philippines. China said, how nice, but they're ours. And now the Philippines said, okay, I guess we'll have a joint oil and gas project there.
All right. We're going to talk more about China in just a minute after a discussion on trade. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from Washington on the Voice of America. A reminder that it's available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com and don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Emily Tamkin, Foreign Affairs Reporter for BuzzFeed News, and Richard Latendresse, Washington Correspondent for Canadian-based TV8 Nouvelle. Our moderator is Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today.
Welcome back. We were just talking about Russia and China. Let's stay on China for a couple of minutes. The U.S., as I'm sure most listeners know, is fighting a four-front trade war with the European Union, Canada, Mexico, and China. On China, there's talk, Richard, that both sides are maybe talking about meeting again. They've been on again, off again talks. Now they might be on again, but President Trump seems sort of ambivalent about this. Why?
Well, again, the president uses this China reality as a way to, again, inflame his electorate. When he was in Montana, he came back on the topic again. The idea is that China is perceived as a unfair trade partner by the president, and he's threatening $200 billion of Chinese imports, which would bring the tariffs up to $250 billion, and it could go even higher. So the idea is that it's tough because obviously there are members of his administration who wants to go further in the discussions with China, but the president keeps pointing at the unfair attitude of the Chinese and then the threat of new tariffs, which doesn't help us in understanding where are the negotiations going. If you allow me, Paul, it's the same impression we have on our side of the border in Canada, where the president keeps saying discussions on renewing NAFTA are going well, and we're honestly discussing the whole thing, negotiating a new trade pact. And then if Canada does not make major concessions, then we're going to go along with Mexico, and that's it. So what is the clear signal each time? It's never
easy to understand.
And this ambivalence, in fact, is kind of based on what President Trump seems to think is the stronger hand that he has in terms of the U.S. economy. He's doing pretty well now. He cites the rising stock market, and he points to China and says, look, they're really struggling right now. Their stock market has actually fallen rather sharply this year. To Trump, this is just a validation of his view that he has the upper hand here, and he's going to hang tough. But Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, he does not appear to be in the mood to back down either.
Correct. And the Richard is right in the concessions that he's demanding, that the administration is demanding, would call for a major restructuring of China's industrial policy. The difference is, respectfully toward Canada, that Canada is much more economically dependent on the United States than China is, right? Where, yes, there are economic relations, but it's not the same as Canada and the United States. And I would also agree that, you know, the president may think that he has a strong hand. It would surely be a stronger hand were he not fighting three other trade wars or spats or whatever you want to call them with our closest allies. I would just also note that I think I'm always loath to try to read the president's mind, but I think in his head, economic relations with China are connected to negotiations on North Korea, are connected to, you know, all these other geopolitical sort of lines of relations.
Do you think he's really connecting the dots that way?
I do think that he thinks, well, I, you know, we can't put too much pressure on them here because they need to cooperate with North Korea, or, you know, I'm going to be really economically tough on them so that they cooperate on North Korea. Which actually the Japanese in particular have really cautioned the U.S. administration not to do, right? Like not to think of the economic sphere and the North Korea sphere together, because it's how you end up making sort of rash military decisions to get an economic deal or vice versa. But I think that in his head, it's sort of all China. And I think that North Korea is at the forefront of this president or this administration's mind.
And yet, Richard, you know, Trump thinks he's making progress on these multiple fronts that Emily was talking about. But if you look at each one of them objectively, North Korea does not appear to be going particularly well right now. And the trade talks with China are not going particularly well either. So what exactly has the president been able to do from your vantage point?
Well, at the moment, nothing clear. He succeeded to get something out of the discussion, the negotiations with Mexico, this new pact that he wants to call the USMC instead of NAFTA, and he's going to get rid of the C for Canada if Canada does not. It's easy to call it the USM. But besides this, besides what he succeeded to get from the Mexican, which is actually interesting, you know, like the workers, a certain percentage of auto workers will make at least $19 in Mexico, which is, I mean, you can see, but it's still a very small improvement to a major trade agreement. And it brings us back to CORUS, the agreement with South Korea, the trade agreement with South Korea, which was presented as another hugely unfair trade deal for the U.S. and needed to be stopped and rewritten. And it was just like small little things. And the president used this as a major gain. I at the moment, you don't see where we're going, even with North Korea. If we put the trade aspect to this, North Korea, for the denuclearization steps, experts, not only foreign experts, but even Americans are saying nothing has been clearly done on their side. And if Secretary Pompeo hasn't been on the ground, it's pretty obvious that it would just give North Korea another opportunity to get legitimacy while not showing any serious signs of changing their missile and nuclear program.
Is it your view as a foreigner that most Americans understand how tariffs will personally impact then? And what I mean by that is sort of American farmers understand they're now paying a price. Apple came out a few days ago and said, well, we could make an iPhone here in the United States. It would be vastly more expensive. And the president talks about the tariffs that are going to bring in billions of dollars to the Treasury. Those tariffs, though, are paid by American consumers. Do they understand these things, you think?
I think not, Paul. But I don't want to be too severe towards American consumers because the Canadians are the same. I think we underestimate how much of everything we have around us has been made or goes through China. And so you take for granted that this is the price of a certain item, and if there's tariffs, somebody else somewhere is going to assume the consequences. So I don't think the Americans are conscious of this, but even the Canadians, and probably it's the same thing in Europe. And this could be one of the good thing out of this entire spat is, just like in Canada, when we pay our whatever we buy, then the taxes are added. So you see a price, $100, but actually you pay $115 in the end. And people say, why don't you say it's going to be $115? Well, it's just because we want you to know that you're paying $15 in taxes. Well, the same thing. If we succeeded to say, okay, that was $100, but now it's $150 because the Chinese have to assume these tariffs, and you are going to pay for them, then you know the share of whatever we're buying are from China.
Politicians are the same everywhere, aren't they? Yeah. You know, there's talk that Trump and Xi, in fact, may talk about this in a couple of weeks at the sort of the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, and again, maybe at the G20 in Argentina. We've got just a couple of minutes left, and there's one other topic that we wanted to get to kind of quickly. This recent vote in Sweden, which has always been rather tolerant and welcoming towards immigrants, it looks like that is kind of a changing a little bit. What happened in this vote the other day, and sort of tell us briefly about the significance of it?
Yeah, so the populists the Populist Party did well. They did not do as well as people were worried or thought they might, but they do now have a much stronger or much louder voice in the coalition building process. I think more than, or at least as much as, oh my God, populists are on the rise in Sweden, people should be looking at traditional parties in Sweden are not holding the center in the way that they used to. And it's not death, but the illness of establishment political parties, and why that is in Sweden, I think, is the much more interesting and important story right now.
And Richard, sort of the broader observation here, Sweden is sort of on a proportional standpoint. I think they've let more people into their country than even Germany mm-hmm. in absolute numbers, but on a relative basis, it has been Sweden. So that is now a big issue. In terms of Europe in general, this anti-immigration movement, has it yet to peak? Are we going to see more, you think? What do you think?
That's a good question. I think the anti-immigration movement has been boosted by the 2015 flood of Syrian refugees. But as Emily said, I think there are two dimensions in this. There's this immigration reality, and then there's the anti-establishment reaction by the electorate. We saw this in Italy. It's not just the League anti-immigration platform that succeeded, but also the Five Star Movement, which is like all sorts of everything but the usual party. So my question is obviously the establishment party, the classic social democrats and Christian democrats in Europe, are losing the younger voters. They're using the union voters. There's an interesting trend there. They're choosing definitely more populist movement, and there's Sweden, there's Germany, there's Austria, Hungary, Italy. I mean, it's all over the place. Yeah. They didn't succeed in France, but they're still very much there. So
but the tide is rising.
The tide is there, obviously. Yeah. And how far is it going to go? I think at the moment you don't see an answer coming from the usual old social democrats or Christian democrats to this new reality. And if you allow me, Paul, the Swedish reality is fascinating because it remains a rich society which takes care of everybody. And still, the people have the impression that slowly their identity, their society is not what it used to be.
Even here in the United States, and we've got about 30 seconds left here, Emily, sort of this view that immigrants are kind of overrunning the United States. That's debatable. Some people think not necessarily so, but President Trump certainly thinks that, and the administration, in fact, is really trying to tamp down not just on undocumented immigrants, but even legal immigrants as well, right?
Yeah, two things. One, I would note that in France, actually, a non-establishment party did win. En Marche was a new party, so it wasn't a traditional party. And two, I would also note that here and in Europe, the main wave of immigrants, the 2015 wave, we're not seeing immigration at those levels anymore. So I would just raise the question as to whether perhaps this rhetoric is more politically convenient than it is reflective of the reality of what immigrants are, quote unquote, doing to these countries.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to Emily Tamkin of BuzzFeed News and Richard LaTendresse. He's with Canada's TVA Nouvelle. This program was produced by The Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thank you for joining us.